F. Gonzalez, Jr. Mr. Lancaster, good morning to you.
Good morning. If you may please support counsel. My name is Todd Lancaster from the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy. I represent Raymond Gonzalez. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal today. This is a case in which Mr. Gonzalez was convicted of first-degree murder and use of a weapon to commit that murder. I'm going to review some of the facts simply because some of the timing is important. Essentially what happened at the Baker's residence was there was a party that was going on basically from Friday through Sunday. Lots of drinking, lots of people there coming and going. Mr. Gonzalez arrived there, drank through Friday and Saturday. At some point Friday or Saturday night, he was very drunk and kind of passed out. Elmer Baker, one of the residents there, put him in his bedroom. Later on went into that bedroom where Mr. Gonzalez was passed out. And at some point, there was some kind of sexual contact that may have been not consensual. When Mr. Gonzalez woke up in the morning, he was upset about that. Some of the other people there were teasing him about having been with Mr. Baker.
What was the deceased teasing him? The deceased
no,
victim?
No, it was Bonnie Baker was the deceased. Elmer Baker was her brother.
She wasn't teasing him.
No, she was. Right. Well, there's no real evidence that she was. Other people there were. Sunday morning about 10 or 11 o'clock, according to most of the witnesses, Mr. Gonzalez and a group of people get in the car and leave. Mr. Gonzalez is dropped off. On the way there, a witness says that she hears him say something to the effect, "When I come back, I'm going to light the place up like a fireworks show." Mr. Gonzalez goes to his mother's house where he finds his sister and his mother. They testified that he was upset, crying about what had happened at this gathering. His cousins are called Louis Hausman, Tony Hausman, and David Rodriguez. They show up to console him or talk to him. They stay around for a while, and then they leave. Witnesses say around 1:30, 2 o'clock, Mr. Gonzalez stays at his mother's residence. The police are called to the Baker's residence about 1:24, I think is the dispatch, where they find Bonnie Baker there. She's been shot several times, and she's deceased. Witnesses at the scene testify that they see various witnesses. They hear a noise. They see somebody running from the Baker residence. They can only describe him generally in terms of height 5'6", 5'7", medium weight, wearing a blue hoodie. And that's about it. The only witness that really has a good description of him is a man named Nunez, who goes outside, sees the person running, goes back into his trailer, sees the person run past some trailers, jump over a fence, and get into a gold car. He describes the shooter as being someone wearing khaki pants. It came out at trial that everybody saw that Mr. Gonzalez was wearing black pants throughout his time at the Baker residence. Throughout his time when he was at his mother's house, he was wearing black pants, never changed his clothes at his mother's house. So the eyewitnesses, none of them can ID him as the person they saw. They just give general description of clothing, and the clothing, at least from one witness, doesn't match Mr. Gonzalez. Mr. Gonzalez is arrested. He's interviewed over a period of 8 hours by multiple officers. He's consistent throughout all of his statements to the police. "I didn't shoot Bonnie Baker, and I didn't go back to that trailer." He never changes that story. He has his hands tested for what's called gunshot residue. The state called an expert witness that testified when somebody fires a gun. Particles that compose gunshot residue compose of three different particles. She testified that if somebody were to shoot a gun, she would expect to see hundreds of those particles on the person, on their clothing. She also testified that those particles can be transferred from an officer touching somebody, putting them in cuffs, by putting them in the back of a police car, be transferred by sitting them in a interrogation room where there's gunshot residue. Testified about studies where people who had no gunshot residue sat in police cars, sat in interview rooms, were touched by officers, and had lots of gunshot residue on them. They found one particle of gunshot residue on Mr. Gonzalez's hand. That's the only thing they found as far as gunshot residue. At trial, The state called Mr. Gonzalez's cousins. They all testified, well, Mr. Rodriguez and Mr. Tony Hausman testified they picked up Mr. Gonzalez at the Attacat Trailer Park earlier in the morning, before noon or before 11, which is inconsistent with all the testimony that people said they were at Mr. Gonzalez's mother's house at that time. And it's inconsistent with the witnesses at the scene who said they left with Mr. Gonzalez around 10 or 11. They testified that they picked Mr. Gonzalez up at that trailer park, though. During the closing arguments, the state commented on the credibility of Mr. Gonzalez, saying that he lied, that his story was just that, a story. Once you tell a lie, a lie is a lie, no matter how many times you tell it. Those various things. There was an objection to that, and that was sustained, a limiting instruction given. One of the things the state did was put up on the overhead a checklist, basically saying he lied about the facts, meaning Mr. Gonzalez.
But doesn't that happen in every criminal, well, not every criminal case, but the prosecutor would get up and discuss or argue with the jury or discuss with the jury that the credibility of the defendant is at stake?
And certainly it's okay, and I think permissible, to discuss the credibility, but to flat out come out and call somebody a liar, I think is impermissible and improper. Many states agree with that. Just saying he's a liar is improper. Other states say it's improper if it's a personal opinion of the person saying it.
How is a prosecutor supposed to say it correctly if they are wanting to call credibility to a jury's attention?
For example, in Alarcon Chavez, the prosecutor called him a liar. That was objected to. But the issue in that case was Mr. Chavez testified. He testified about two different things. He said one thing, and then he said another one that was inconsistent. In this case, Mr. Gonzalez did testify. His recording was played. He was completely consistent. So if the prosecution wants to attack somebody's credibility, saying this person is lying, they can say they gave inconsistent statements. In this particular case, though, what happened was prosecution said Mr. Gonzalez is lying because his statements are different from somebody else's. That's invading the province of the jury, as opposed to saying Mr. Gonzalez's statements are inconsistent with this person's statement. So not just calling a liar, I think, is improper, but also expressing your personal opinion. I don't believe this guy, and you, the jury, shouldn't believe him either.
Did the prosecutor do that in this case? Did he say, I don't believe Mr. Gonzalez?
He did. Well, he certainly implied that Mr. Gonzalez was lying. When they put up the overhead on the screen for the jury to see, one of the categories was lied about the facts. Dozens of times he checked off Mr. Gonzalez lied about the facts. I think that's calling him a liar. The other things he testified about were, you know, he gave the same story again and again. We've all agreed that, you know, a lie is a lie no matter when, how many times you say it.
What evidence is there of provocation? And are you using provocation as a reason for the killing, or are you using provocation as a sudden quarrel, which the party was then uncontrollable? His actions were uncontrolled because his mind was kind of enraged.
Lost his ability to reason and reflect, yes, and deliberate.
So what's your position on the provocation?
Certainly the jury found that Mr. Gonzalez was the shooter. If the jury found Mr. Gonzalez was the shooter, they should have been instructed that if the shooting was a result of sudden quarrel based upon provocation. In this case, the provocation would be essentially being sexually assaulted by Elmer Baker while he was drunk or passed out in the bed.
But your theory was, I wasn't there and I didn't shoot him, so why would there be a provocation instruction?
The jury should be properly instructed. If the jury believed that he was the shooter, they should have been properly instructed as the law regarding sudden quarrel. Even if our argument was it wasn't
the
shooter.
Well, the provocation was what, he left the scene and was gone 5 hours?
The testimony was that they left around 11. The shooting was called in at 1:24.
Is his theory that Luis did the shooting?
That was one of the theories at trial, that Luis and Mr. Rodriguez and Tony Hausman left the mother's home and went and did the shooting. That was one of the theories that we argued at trial.
But the deceased didn't provoke the defendant, did she?
Correct.
So why would the provocation be directed to the innocent party?
Well, if the idea is that you're so provoked that your power of reasoning has been obscured, you're acting out rashly, that even if he's provoked by Elmer Baker, when he goes over to do the shooting, that provocation is what he's doing. And if you shoot somebody else, unfortunate, but that's based on that provocation. I think if you look at State versus Rinker, R-I-N-C-K-E-R, in that case, the defendant went to the mother's, to a house where his wife was at with some people. He was upset at his wife and shot one of the other people.
But if you say what you're going to do, and it's 2 or 3 hours later that you do what you say you were going to do, is that sudden quarrel argument, or that what provocation here is, you provoked me and I decided to kill you.
Well,
and so he went to that place and shot whoever was in there 16 times.
Well, the definition that has been used often with sudden quarrel is that it does not necessarily mean an exchange of angry words or an altercation contemporaneously with the unlawful killing. Certainly,
well,
this wasn't contemporaneously.
No, but there is some limitation, isn't there? What you're arguing with provocation is he was insane and out of his mind for three to five hours, but when he said, I'm going to kill somebody, then somebody said, well, if you have a problem, let's take it outside. And he said, no, I'm just kidding. Well, and he denies that he was even agitated.
And the statement he makes in the car, I'm going to come back and light it up like a fireworks show. Clearly, that's showing that he's still upset.
Well, he may be upset, but he knows exactly what he's going to do, doesn't he?
Well,
and knowing what you're going to do is different than having your mind lost because of sudden rage or an incident that happens with regard to a sudden quarrel.
And I think it's for the jury to determine if that provocation, is that the basis of the killing, and whether how long that lasts, whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, is a question for the jury. If it's sufficient provocation, the duration, if he's still under the effect of that, should be a question for the jury to determine.
What if it's 2 weeks later?
I would say if it's 2 weeks, that had to be a really enormous provocation. I don't know if the provocation could last that long.
You think as a matter of law, provocation can last 2 weeks?
It'd be hard for me to say it could last 2 weeks.
So there is some outer limit.
There is some. I don't know what it is, though. If, for example, the classic example is you go in and find your wife with somebody, you're provoked right away. If that happened through a text message or a letter or a phone call, hey, I'm with somebody and we're having an affair, how long would that provoke you? How long would you still be under the influence of that provocation? I guess is a question.
Would you be out of your mind long enough to say, oh, I'm just kidding? Does that indicate that you're thinking one way or the other and you know exactly what you want to do when somebody confronts you with this and then you say, no, I didn't mean that, I'm just kidding?
Well, the testimony was that he says that to Elmer Baker. The testimony also was that when he gets back to his mother's house, he's still under that provoking event. He's still upset, he's still crying. Can he say, I'm just kidding, or I don't mean it? I think he certainly can. I mean, the human mind is full of foibles that we say things when we're still angry to say we're not angry when we actually are.
Well, angry is different than being provoked.
Provoked when we actually are still provoked, I guess I would say.
Okay.
Looks like I'm out of time, so if there's no more questions.
I think we shortchanged you a bit. This is potentially a 20-minute argument. So. I think you've got at least 5 minutes here. 6:08.
Well, why don't I save my 6:08 for a rebuttal?
That is up to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
please the court. My name is Austin Relf. I represent the state of Nebraska. Three assigned errors on appeal. Prosecutorial misconduct during closing arguments. Alleged prosecutorial misconduct. Insufficient evidence. And jury instructions. I'll address each of those in turn, but briefly, our positions are without merit. We ask this court to affirm the judgment below. I won't recite the facts. I think my brief went through everything. I just did want to say a couple of points. One, defendant, under the state's theory, and I think the evidence showed, did not stay at his mother's residence the entire afternoon. He left with his two cousins, David Rodriguez and Tony Hausman. Second, the prosecutor never called the defendant a liar, to the extent there's a distinction between liar and saying this is a lie. The prosecutor did not cross that line. And the State versus Alarcon Chavez, my reading of that case, the testimony by the defendant there was not inconsistent with itself. It was inconsistent with other evidence. And so the prosecutor there said you saw him lying. But the prosecutorial misconduct, I think the framework is relatively well established. As I set forth in my brief, the general rule is that if it's common on the evidence or based on the evidence, it's proper. And my reading of the case law suggests that's true even when the comment or statement comes in the form of the prosecutor's belief or opinion, provided that belief or opinion is given as a deduction of the evidence. In our view, that's exactly what the prosecutor did here. The story comment, the once a lie, always a lie comment, were comments on the evidence, particularly the defendant's statement to the police and investigators, and how it was inconsistent with other evidence. The checklist and the scenario where the prosecutor is comparing David Rodriguez and the defendant as far as when they went back to Attica, again, a proper inference based on the evidence, and the statement about the science fiction or make-believe regarding the anonymous drug dealer defense, again, I think that was proper in that there was no evidence supporting that, and I disagree with the appellant that it was a straw man. My reading of the evidence is that on the particularly the cross-examination of Sergeant Hadding, the defense attorney, the defendant, questioned him about his position with the Tri-State Drug Force, brought up the link between drugs and violence, how a lot of times drug deals go bad and you know, killing or death can result, bad things happen. In my view, he raised sort of the specter of, hey, maybe this was just a drug deal gone bad. And so the prosecutor was well within his rights to say, no, I mean, there's no evidence of that. It's make-believe. It's science fiction. I don't think that crosses any line. So in our view, there was no prosecutorial misconduct. Statements were proper as comments on the evidence or based on the evidence. And to the extent, you know, even if this court disagrees, no prejudice could have resulted, as I set forth in my brief. The district court apparently agreed with the defendant that these comments were improper, but gave a pretty thorough curative instruction to the jury saying, hey, this once a lie, always a lie comment, this story comment, those are inappropriate. A prosecutor's not supposed to comment on credibility or give opinion. That's for the jury. Disregard those comments. I don't know how any prejudice could have resulted, particularly with the presumption that the jury follows its instructions. On the sufficiency of the evidence, I didn't really have too much to add to what I said in my brief. I think, of course, under the applicable standard of review, it's in favor of the state. The inferences to be drawn, a rational trier of fact can find all the reasonable, all the essential elements of the crime beyond reasonable doubt. Sort of a quick bullet point list. Evidence showed he was very upset. He made threats at the party, particularly to Elmer, as well as to just generally, I'm going to light this place up. When I come back, it's going to be like a fireworks show. The testimony shows that he's dropped off at his mother's house. He's, again, still very upset, talking with his sister and his cousins come over. They try and console him, basically. They leave for a short period during the afternoon, and there's evidence showing that, you know, it's basically 5.7 miles from mom's house to the scene of the crime. It took about 12 minutes when driven a year later on Sunday by one of the investigators. So a short window of time, he's gone. He's got the motive. I understand that the descriptions of the shooter by the eyewitnesses are inconsistent on points, but as I said in my brief, they're generally consistent with his general description, both clothes and physical appearance. So the evidence was sufficient to find, and the jury did find, that he was the shooter and guilty of these crimes. Third issue, jury instructions. As I set forth in my brief, I think they're pretty much taken care of by Heinrichsen. Basically, same arguments made, due process concerns about negative element of sudden quarrel, as well as the definition of sudden quarrel. Patterson dealt with that.
So do you agree with counsel that, well, that he should have had the provocation instruction, even though his theory of defense is, I wasn't there and I didn't do it?
Well, I wouldn't. The theory of defense to me isn't the critical point, because presumably the jury, you know, rejected that theory of defense. And if they reject that theory of defense, they still have to categorize the degree of the homicide. So if there's evidence to support, even if it's not the theory of defense, then the instruction should be given. But in this particular case, as Justice Wright was emphasizing, there's no evidence warranting a sudden quarrel instruction because of the length of time. Even if you want to say he was provoked, provocations early Sunday morning, say 6, 7 in the morning, shootings at 1:15 in the afternoon, this court has repeatedly said that that length of time, well, not that particular length of time, the State v. Lyle, a 1994 case, is well established that if one had enough time between the provocation and the killing to reflect on one's intended course of action, the mere presence of passion does not reduce the crime to a little murder. So he had plenty of time to think about it. He did think about it. He talked with his cousins. He talked with his sister. He made threats. You know, he knew what he was doing.
With respect to provoke, do you think that who's the universe of people who could provoke from the standpoint of provocation in the law? Must it be the victim, or could it be other people?
Well, I guess I hadn't thought about that. I suppose it could be somebody else. If the idea is the provocation makes you unable to think, then I guess wherever that provocation comes from, if it's sufficient legal provocation.
In this case, is this correct in your, or is this your view that in this case there's no evidence that the victim, no testimony to the effect that the victim provoked the defendant
in this
particular matter?
Correct. Any provocation would have been between, or would have been caused by.
There was a group that may have provoked him. If provocation there was.
Right. The victim, okay. Bonnie Baker, was not involved in the teasing, or obviously in the sexual part with Elmer and Gonzalez.
What was his claim with regard to what the instructions should include? Didn't he argue that the instructions should include a statement that it was the state's burden to prove that the killing was not based upon a sudden quarrel?
My recollection, yes, is that
that would add another element to the crime, wouldn't it?
Right. They asked for an additional element, basically in the first degree murder elements instruction, saying that it was not the result of a sudden quarrel. Like and as I view Heinrichsen, this court rejected that argument, saying basically that the
we answered that when we defined the elements of first degree murder, and that it wasn't the state's burden to prove the negative on that it wasn't the result of a sudden quarrel.
Well, I think Heinrichsen said that not that it's not the state's burden to prove, but that the state met its burden to prove inherently by showing purpose, deliberated malice. So I think this court said in Heinrichsen, there's no shifting of the burden of proof. You met the burden of proof when you proved these elements, and so you don't need an explicit jury instruction talking about the negative element of sudden quarrel.
Was it a burden of persuasion?
Well, no, it'd be a burden of proof. The burden of persuasion, I mean, any evidence that, say, the defendant brought up would still be relevant to the question of whether there's deliberate killing, all of the evidence would come together. It's still the state's burden of proof, but any evidence would be relevant.
It's the defendant that has to offer the evidence of provocation as an affirmative defense,
which
is his burden is by preponderance, and the state's burden to prove the elements of first-degree murder is by beyond a reasonable doubt.
And
our theory is that once you prove those elements, you have proved that there is no provocation.
It's certainly, the defendant's the only one that's going to be offering evidence of sudden quarrel and provocation or whatnot. I think that's just sort of a logical conclusion. I read Heinrichsen as saying the burden never shifts from the prosecutor, from the state. It's just that all this evidence comes in, and naturally the prosecutor has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there wasn't a sudden quarrel, because that's necessary to prove purposeful, intentional killing.
In this case, if I understand your argument, is you're saying there is no evidence of sudden provocation, so...
Correct.
This conversation is idle.
Yeah.
With respect to what the state should or should not have done with respect to a potential defense,
right,
affirmative defense.
Right, I mean, our position, like I said, any error, his assigned errors are without merit based on Heinrichsen, but I wanted to also add that, in my view, there's no evidence supporting sudden quarrel, period, because of the length of time and he was able to consider what he, you know, his actions. That basically is my presentation. I would submit it unless this court has any further questions. I ask you to affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How much time do we have for rebuttal?
We have 6 minutes and 1 second.
6 minutes and 1 second. Mr. Lancaster.
Thank you. Just a couple comments. The testimony about Tony Houseman, David Rodriguez, and Mr. Gonzalez leaving, I think from the sister, was they left for 15 to 20 minutes. I think they said they went out and had a cigarette. Mr. Gonzalez came back in. Mr. Houseman and Rodriguez left. Certainly, if it takes 12 minutes to get to the scene of the crime, you can't go to the scene of the crime, commit the crime, come back in that 24 minutes when you're outside for only 20 minutes.
Nobody had a stopwatch on them.
I'm sorry?
No one had a stopwatch on these.
That's
people.
Correct. And these times...
estimates.
Isn't that a credibility issue for the jury, and that was resolved against you?
Those are facts for the jury. I just want to clear up what the state was saying about the time frames. There was an instruction after the trial court found the comments were improper. The instruction did say ignore the comment about, once a story, always a story. But the curative instruction didn't say ignore that the state just put up on the overhead a checklist that said lied about the facts, meaning Mr. Gonzalez. That's Exhibit 156. So the state did call him a liar, because when they're saying he lied about the facts, the state is straight up calling Mr. Gonzalez a liar. And obviously, our position is that's improper because it carries the weight of the prosecuting attorney, and their opinion has more, gravitas to the jury. So when they're saying this person is a liar, the risk is that the jury is going to follow the prosecution's opinion and substitute it for their own. And that's one of the prejudice, one of the problems with the state straight out calling the defendant a liar.
When one is assessing such a comment, don't you have to look at the comment in the context of the entire argument?
I think you do.
And how would you characterize the comment that you're talking about vis-a-vis the entirety of the closing argument?
The entirety of the closing argument was that Mr. Gonzalez lied when he said he didn't go there and shoot Ms. Baker, and that he lied when he didn't go back. Now, his statements throughout were consistent that he didn't do that. Now, if a witness had said, for example, I didn't go back, oh wait, I did go back, or I didn't do A, but okay, I did do A and I didn't do B. If they're making inconsistent statements or they flat out say, I lied about something, then I think it's okay for the prosecutor to say, well, he lied. But in this particular case, Mr. Gonzalez is completely consistent. What is happening is the prosecution is making their own judgment about the truthfulness of his statements and giving that to the jury because the prosecution doesn't believe Mr. Gonzalez, they believe somebody else. But in this context, Mr. Gonzalez never said, oh, I'm sorry, I lied about this thing, or was ever inconsistent with any of his testimony about what he did or where he was.
I guess what I was perhaps asking, would you disagree with the characterization of the closing argument as a collection of facts that would tend to contradict your client's testimony?
Whether they contradict my client's testimony or not, it's improper for the prosecution attorney to say, this person lied. That's a decision
that's a
for the jury
line.
To determine, not for the judge or the prosecutor to tell the jury who's lying. They should make that decision on their own.
In your view, it's a bright line rule.
It's a bright line rule.
Appears have we ever said that?
This court has never said that. Other courts have, and I list those those states that do that in my brief, Iowa, Kansas, Colorado, South Dakota, North Dakota, 13 other states say it's just straight out improper to call the defendant a liar. Other states say, well, if it's your personal opinion, then that's improper unless it's based on, you know, facts that you can point to in the record where he can be proven to be a liar.
So who really has to prove provocation in this case?
I think the defense has to show that there is some provocation. I think, as you said, by preponderance. Okay. But then I think it's the state has to prove that there was a provocation.
Well, the state has to prove the elements of the crime. But what? How can you say I was never there? And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, and then ask for a provocation instruction. It's the defendant that has to indicate some way that he was provoked, doesn't he? That he didn't, it was a sudden quarrel, or he was enraged. And in Hendrickson, we didn't have to wrestle that problem because there was no question that the defendant admitted he was there and that he did the shooting. In this case, how can you argue that I'm entitled to provocation instruction when you deny ever being there?
And I think that was one of the questions in Henderson is, what if he didn't testify? Can you get a provocation instruction if you don't testify? I think the facts of the case, whether a defendant testifies, if the facts show that there's this provocation, whether the defendant's saying he was there or
well, that would be, you'd make a stronger argument if the defendant didn't testify, because it wouldn't be a blatant denial that he wasn't there, and so the jury could then consider whether or not his actions were the result of a sudden quarrel. But in this case, where there is evidence that he was not there, should the jury have to consider provocation?
In this case, Mr. Gonzalez didn't testify. His statements to the police were put on by the prosecution.
Well, but
now, if he didn't,
he testified by making those statements. He testified.
And if he had made those statements, for example, and all the jury heard were the facts without his statements, then it's clearly there's an issue of provocation. Does he still get that instruction?
That, you're saying this provocation got into the case by virtue of the statements.
The provocation got into the case based on the evidence that the state put on about people making fun of him for being with Mr. Baker and teasing him and getting him upset based on this stuff, and also by the fact that Mr. Baker testified that he had sexual contact with Mr. Gonzalez when he was essentially passed out drunk. I think that's where the provocation starts. I think it comes into the case through the evidence that the state puts on. I think it can also come into the case through the evidence that a defendant puts on by testifying and putting on other evidence. If there are no more questions, I would ask the court to reverse based on our issues and remand and grant a new trial for Mr. Baker.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day is State versus David K. Harrison. I believe Mr. Harrison is pro se. Is there anybody here today on behalf of Mr.